Welcome to the Fourth Watch Podcast, a curated conversation with some of the most interesting voices in the media. I'm Steve Krakauer. Today I'm joined by Bridget Fedezy, writer, podcaster, video host, sometimes stand-up comic, all-around hilarious and insightful voice in the media. This is episode 50. From being politically homeless and politically useless, to the characteristics of being a writer, to how marriage and motherhood changed her, we begin with the state of our crazy, chaotic 2024 political moment. Thanks for doing this. Always good talking
to
you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about where we're at right now as we end August. We have a former president getting arrested for the fourth time, his former vice president among a dozen people running against him as he tries to get elected for a second time, but saying that it's the third time. We have our current president, who is historically unpopular, an obvious cognitive decline, running for re-election, but also vacationing most of the time. He also might get impeached later this year. Or maybe next year. That's kind of a thing also. So how are you feeling about everything?
It's pretty dark. I feel like I'm just an average person on a lot of things, and I'm not very passionate about any of the people who are running. It seems sad to me that these are our options, and it makes me feel, I don't know, it gives me like a bad, weird feeling that I'm having a hard time articulating.
Yeah. Well, this will be a theme of this episode here, because I think one of the great things about you that I actually, I share a lot of I think your point of view is this concept of politically homeless in a lot of ways, which I think we're going to get to. So this great section that you have on your Substack, but also just this, I think, point of view that that most people are not as crazy as it might appear when you watch cable news or you follow along on Twitter. You had this great column in The Spectator recently called "Real America is the Middle Seat in Coach," which I also watched in video form in this epic rant you had on Dumpster Fire, which was fantastic. I would suggest everyone go and do that. I'll link it. But, the point is that, and again, you can tell the point, but there is a lot more that's connecting us in this crazy time than dividing us, even if maybe people on either end of the spectrum would rather we get divided over some of these issues.
And also it seems like we are trapped in this binary. So it does come down to generally two choices in an election, and people will say, you've got to, pick a side, or call me like captain of the fence riding team. I understand when people say that centrist, for lack of a better word, even though I don't really feel like I'm a centrist by any, I don't really even know what that means, but I joked on Twitter that I'm not politically homeless, I'm politically useless. And there is a lot of truth to that. There's people on both sides will tell you that they are defending the soul of America, and they believe that. And perhaps there's some truth to both sides and how they view things and what they're saying. And on the right, I would say I get accused of uselessness mostly because the left is so dominant. They dominate academia. They dominate, people generally are more afraid to speak out if they're on the left and or if they're around coworkers who are of the left than right. I would say vice versa. So the argument is there's one party that's generally a lot more dominant in tech and media and entertainment, and they're the people who are censoring and driving more of the censorship and the people that need to be defeated. So I can unfortunately see where everyone's coming from.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not, even in the column that you write, this idea of like real America versus the coastal elites or just elites in general, again, non-politically necessarily the elites on the left, elites on the right, just better people in power. That is a real dynamic. And at the same time, it does feel like it kind of what you get at there. And it's a dynamic that I think for whatever reason does seem to really pop up a lot at airports and on airplanes. Like there is this idea where it's like, we're going to band together. Like if we band together against this, you know, airline or against, you know, this terrible situation that we're in, you can get a lot done. And it seems sort of corny to say, but it's like, we're not worrying about what side of the what your policy opinions are in these moments. It's like we have the ability to do that by kind of getting together ourselves.
Yeah, and I think I see. I was driving just when we were coming home and headed to the airport. I was thinking about that column because it came out that day that I was headed to the airport from my vacation, and there was all these people in traffic, and I'm like, real America. I'm not sure real America knows many rich people. This is my new working theory that they don't understand that I've been to like these boondoggles where people from all sides of the spectrum, people who ostensibly hate one another, public facing or battle one another, are all in conference rooms together. They're all listening to speakers talk about how they can make more money. They all talk about the masses as if they're other because they are. And they fly private jets. They're not dealing with traffic. They don't have to deal with most of the nuisances that the average person have to deal with in any given day. And that separates them from normals. And even last night on the debates, I was shocked that healthcare didn't come up once. How is that not a topic? That is like the probably number one or two problem most Americans face in their life. And it's also probably a huge expense unless they have, you know, a good job with healthcare. But even right. then.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that, there were a few things in the debate, I think, that were, I mean, the topic selection, I think, was one that was interesting, but also they do this thing. I think they do it a lot at most of these debates where when they go to commercial break, they have the commercial playing, but then you can also watch the stage. I'm always fascinated by that. You know, Mike Pence and Vivek Ramaswamy have this like really fiery moment, and then you can watch and they're just kind of chit chatting up there. And you're like, I don't think they're continuing this fight. I think they're probably okay. The cameras are off. I mean, they clearly, I don't think they don't love each other or anything, but it's not, there's a little bit of a sense of, there's a show to it and that's not serving the average person in a way that, you know, to be honest, I mean, we haven't mentioned Trump yet necessarily, but by name, but that was the big disruption to it, to this idea of like, you know, the elites versus everyone else. Maybe that was what was so terrifying, when he was kind of accrued some level of power, I guess.
Yeah, I always never really understood that either. Right-wing populism is really strange to me. It seems like even that song that they played at the beginning, the one that's like
they started
huge.
It. Yeah, Richmond North of Richmond.
The Richmond North. That song is strange to me because I listened to it and I'm like, so he's bitching about all the rich men and all of these problems, but he never talks about his boss, you know, like he never actually talks about the rich guy who's employing him or whatever. It's just a very strange, it was like the rise of Trump. I'm like, how is this guy who, you know, takes a poo on golden toilets, some voice of, and a billionaire, like the voice of these disenfranchised poor people, was just something that was remarkable to me. And it does show me that people are more concerned with the culture wars, I guess, than actually the reality of the people who are their reality of life, which is not anything like the reality of the people that they're speaking for on behalf of.
How does one end up being politically homeless and defaulting to trusting us over the elites? I mean, I've a lot of times thought that the Trump phenomenon, and this is, you know, my thought, but also my focus group of a few people that, you know, whether it was like the HVAC guy who passed through, it's like, you know, he pisses off the right people. And it's like, if you piss off the right people, you know, you're not one of us, but at least we're glad to see you bothering people that we want you to be bothering. And I guess the whole idea, I think, of politically homeless, I know, okay, politically useless, that's your new, the new phrase, but I love these stories, you know, that you highlight, people writing in, you say, and you write, politics these days have become so divided and divisive that it's become the norm to view the other side of the aisle as the enemy. People are being told to pick a side and that there's no room for middle ground. But that you believe that there's a lot more people in the middle than politicians and the media would have us believe. And I think that that's 100% true. And I guess I wonder what got you there. Like, what was it that caused you to think that way, to view it that way, and to kind of fight against what has, I think, been increasingly a challenging spot of like not picking a side in a real tangible way?
I think it just really getting caught in the crossfire of the culture wars. If I ever could get around to trying to articulate how this happened or even sit down and really look at it, because I think I got a job at Playboy and I was writing, went from being a waitress and trying to just write in Hollywood and tell jokes to then being very online, as one would say. And I didn't have any of the language that people online had adopted, whether it was in academia, I didn't know anything. And I got really just surprised by how different things were online than offline, as just somebody waiting tables, or it was just very interesting to me that there was like a whole entire parallel discussion happening. And there were terms that I didn't know, like internalized misogyny. I didn't know anything about critical race theory. I didn't know anything. I knew nothing about gender ideology. I'd never heard cis or really all of the language. I just knew nothing. And my editor used to joke that I was like a bro from the 90s who basically came online in the, like, I guess it was 2015 when I got that job. And then at that same exact moment, Trump was ascendant. And I was just thinking about this before we started talking, just like how broken everyone's brains are. And then we were all forced to be online even more during the pandemic. And I'm not sure we even realize how broken our brains are. I was thinking about this because a friend, a relative, like one of my siblings' friends took their life. And it's tragic and horrific. And of course, they post about it online. And some of the first comments are people like, oh, young people, with the, you know, shot emoji. And they're like, I guess it's these vaccines. I'm like, your brain is broken. If that is the first, if you're commenting on this with no knowledge of what happened to this person, you have a broken brain and you actually don't even realize it. But that's just one instance of how I feel like, I don't know how I ended up feeling so lost. And I feel that way even more today as we sit down and talk, because being at Playboy, I was often attacked by the right wing. So then when I started pushing back against some of the left wing low hanging fruit insanity and just questioning a lot of their hypocrisy, I was embraced by the right and I didn't trust them. You know, I'm like, well, I don't trust you. I've seen you calling me a barren, whore and all the other things you say, a 40-year-old who's gone crazy because I didn't have children and a baby killer, whatever the things that they were attacking me with were. So I always looked side-eyed at the right too. And it would have been easy for me to like cash in on that. I easily could have been like, I'm right wing now, and made a lot of money probably during those years. But I don't think I could have slept at night or really looked. I feel very confused, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think to your point about your friend, I mean, it does seem like a real online phenomenon. Like no one has that reaction in real life. You know, even if someone is thinking that, like, I was even just thinking like the use of emojis, like they don't necessarily translate to like real world conversation, you know, like you have to verbalize something when you're putting a little picture of, even if it's like a little face, it just, there's something very detached about it that can cause it. And so, yeah, you build in this detachment and how online people are. And then you just like, you know, give it an extra shot of the divisiveness that can come from wherever, you know, wherever we got divided, maybe because of Trump or that the Trump got, you know, was because we were divided or whatever. But I guess as you look at 2024, you're saying you're feeling even more unsteady about it. But I mean, do you think like from a media perspective, this is where we're headed? Like, are we continuing down this path, or is there a pendulum swing that is potentially coming in the future?
Does everything feel really fragmented to you, or is it just me? Like, yeah. I feel like it's like I keep trying to articulate it, and then the only way I can is like a mirror has been broken and all the pieces are reflecting everywhere, but everything still feels very disjointed and separate. And the algorithms all feel very broken to me. I don't feel like, I'm really struggling. Honestly, I'm not sure. I was just saying to my husband before we spoke, I feel very lost. I just feel like I don't feel like I have a place in the ecosystem at all. I don't know that I want to even engage in the culture wars anymore, because I find them so, I mean, some of it's fun. Like last night I was looking at everybody's commentary on the debates, and some of it was very funny and yeah. It cracks me up. And there is some, like you said, an entertainment value to it, but then everyone has their pet thing that they get very upset about, and their pearls that they'll clutch about one specific thing. And I don't know. I don't know. I feel I've never felt so unsettled. You know, I don't know if it's Trump and Biden for 2024, I'm sitting out again. I don't care. I just can't, you can't bully me into voting for somebody that I cannot get behind, whether because they have absolutely no character or because they have no brain. You know, like I can't, and people will try to, and they'll try and explain why. And I get it. I understand, but I don't think, I also don't believe this is going to be the only election of my life. I don't believe it's going to be the last election. And if I sit it out because the options are horrible or just vote down ballot, then so be it. I mean, I'm not so cynical that I believe either side, when whoever is in charge that is not their team person, is the end of America and the end of democracy.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think, and there's also a difference between not voting in this election and not like getting personally invested in it as well, which is like, and we're about to, even before we get to Trump Biden, it's going to be what already is kind of this vicious intra GOP war that's happening, but it's only going to get more advanced as it really starts to materialize. I mean, there is a lot of very smart people who I like and respect who really do not want Donald Trump to win again. Like they really, and on the right. And as that's becoming a reality, I think that there's going to be it's going to get vicious out there. I've been toying around with this column, which I sometimes like to write things just to see if I can piss everyone off. But like, I don't care who wins. Yeah, I don't care if it's Biden. And but it comes from, I think, a place to kind of like what you're saying, which is that it's not that I don't have preferences or have opinions. It's just, I don't think we're going to be saved by anyone at all. And I also think that I trust us as a people much more than a single person, a single administration is going to destroy us or, you know, I don't think it has that much control over us. Coming up, getting married, having a baby, how life has changed for Bridget as a person and a documenter of our culture. That's next. But first, I want to talk about Elon Musk and his extremely disappointing first year running Twitter. Sorry, X, formerly known as Twitter. As you know, I'm on Substack, and there's drama currently going on between Elon and Substack. I recently wrote a column on this topic. Technically, I can tweet a link to the post and you can read it, but having a link to the story in a tweet or whatever we're calling them now will cause it to be artificially suppressed so much that it will be practically invisible. This is just one admittedly personal gripe. But the truth is, Elon Musk's tenure running one of the biggest social media platforms in the world has been a bizarre mix of own goals and counterproductive decision-making, where the business side always seems to win out over the free speech instincts he conceivably holds dear. Now, I'm not an Elon Musk hater. In fact, I may be one of the earliest people ever to suggest the genius behind Tesla and SpaceX should purchase Twitter in the first place, in a tweet on January 8th, 2021, and in the former iteration of the Fourth Watch newsletter 2 days later. Don't start your own Twitter, I urged freedom-minded founders. The better solution is to install more American values at these existing companies through a power shift, I wrote, which is why Elon Musk should buy Twitter. Now, it's also worth making very clear, I am not in the camp which can easily be described as suffering from Musk derangement syndrome, like CNN's JV Media correspondent who runs their shell of a newsletter now, who wrote a couple weeks ago that X, or what used to be called Twitter, is a warped and disfigured platform. It marches on like a White Walker, an ugly shell of its former self under the command of a loathsome leader. Truly psychopathic editorializing and sophomoric writing. There are others like Kara Swisher who performatively hate Musk now as a means of atonement for her past glowing coverage of the billionaire, the way people like Katie Couric or Gayle King surely hate Donald Trump after having been to his wedding in 2005. But there's no getting around the fact that the promise of a truly open platform, free of an unfair algorithm, fuzzy and arbitrarily applied rules, these have not panned out in a substantial way. You can tweet men aren't women now, sure. But it is those of us who cheered for Elon Musk to take the reins of the platform most responsible for the outrageous Hunter Biden laptop suppression in 2020 who must call it out when these are broken promises. And that does, on some level, get exemplified by Musk's bizarre feud with Substack. Originally, there was some symbiosis between Musk and prominent Substack journalists. There certainly seemed to be philosophical alignment on the value of a free exchange of ideas, encumbered by as little restrictions as possible. But it didn't pan out. You can find out more of that on my Substack, fourthwatch.media. And more with Bridget coming up, but I want to tell you that the full Fourth Watch podcast is also exclusively available to paid subscribers on Substack, where you can find a whole bunch of extra content, including columns like this, deep dive columns called Rabbit Hole. Check it out for just $5 a month, $50 for a year at fourthwatch.media. Now, back to Bridget Fetizy. First of all, you do a lot. You've got, you know, a lot of different mediums, right? You're writing, you've got podcasting, video. Where do you, let me ask you first, like, where you identify as, like, what is your, like, if you were going to say, this is what I do, like, this is my medium of expertise. And then also just kind of more broadly on the state of the media, where do you think that fits with where things are as we end 2023?
I mean, where what I do fits, I don't think it fits anywhere as evidenced by everything, all the metrics. I would say I'm a writer first. Yeah. You know, that is how I make sense of the world. I don't often know what I'm going to think about something until I write my way through it. It's almost like my fingers have some truth that I am not I don't have access to until I sit down and I start writing.
Love that.
And I don't know if it's just because it forces me to slow down too. Just, you know, when you're podcasting or talking, like, and it's so interesting because I think podcasting on the one hand is so great because you can have these conversations that are just free flowing and it feels like you're part of it if you're just listening. But on the other hand, there's no fact checking. There's but anyone can say anything and it can go viral and it could be wrong or it could be something that there aren't really many checks and balances. And so it's easy to just kind of believe whatever you want to believe, depending on what you're listening to.
There's pros and cons to like a low barrier of entry. You know,
I love the medium. I love having conversations with people, but I'm by no means an expert in anything. And I realize that more and more, not that it's stopped anyone else who's making millions of dollars, but they just seem to have like a level of confidence that I don't have access to. I also think I'm reluctantly a stand-up comedian, even though I haven't been on stage in a while. I know that I need to get back because right now Dumpster Fire is kind of functioning as my stand-up, but there's something about interacting with the crowd, whether you're bombing or whether you're doing well, that I think is invigorating and instructive in ways that I don't feel doing it online.
Something tangible about it. Do you write like physically or whenever you're writing, on a laptop or something?
Write in a journal physically, and okay. I actually think that's probably the most honest, self-deprecating stuff that I write. But again, that slows me down even more. You know, there's something about physically putting pen to paper. I also do all of my like goal setting and intentions and things. I do all of that pen to paper too.
Right.
I have like a whole little routine that I go through at the end and beginning of every year. And then every quarter I try to check in, but it's been harder with a baby to maintain a lot of that.
Real big picture thinking. I hear that. But I was just talking to someone about this, about like, I don't know most people's handwriting. People I know very well, like I just, you interact with them in so many different settings and yet you've never like seen their writing, like how they write. It's just a different way of life now. But well, let me ask you about that. Talk about life changes. Got married, had a baby. How would you say these major things have changed? I think maybe, you know, persona wise, it's changed things. But yeah. I also like having those life changes for you at a time when it feels like in some ways, having the more traditional experiences, like having a more traditional family, is kind of subversive in a way. In a way. So where do you, has that changed you and kind of your overall presence?
In some ways it's radicalized me. And I was joking about this when I was on Glenn Beck recently, I was like, I'm politically homeless and I feel lost, but I'm also radicalized in some ways. And in the ways in which I don't get to be the cooler than thou Gen Xer sitting on the sidelines, laughing at everybody, taking all this stuff seriously. Now I actually, I'm like, shit, what are they teaching my kid at school? I don't get to sit on the sidelines of that. And so that has made me more concerned about certain things that I think in the past I was able to just view with like a detached, ironic stance of my Gen X self. In other ways, it's made me care less. It's a very strange paradox. Yeah. And again, I was just thinking about this when I was getting ready for this interview. having her has made me care more about some things. And then when it comes to like the culture war nonsense, I'm like, I cannot find it in myself to care about this, because I'd rather be spending time with her playing or doing something cool out in the world. I have more of a desire to just go on adventures in the world with her. I want to take her out. And I do think I'm seeing more of that too. People just wanting to be more engaged in the real, IRL, as the kids would say.
Exactly.
It seems like people want to be building community and building that experiential. You cannot just substitute online personalities for in real life experience and community. There's just no, it's not the same at all.
No, not at all. And I does feel like there's like some sort of pendulum swing. I was listening to Red Scare recently, and just the kind of conversation they're having. I mean, it's, you know, this cool podcast, but you know, the about kids and, you know, and marriage and things happening in the real world that are not being documented on every, you know, on every social platform. And it feels like a reaction to something in a very, very real tangible way that, you know, maybe it's good for us in that sense also.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, I wrote recently about being in the suburbs, and just, I've always been kind of a little bit of like an urban supremacist, you know, like I've believed very deeply in the cities, and they just were not a safe place for me to raise a child. They didn't feel safe. There was nothing about it that was appealing. I miss museums and things like that, but I think overall, taking my child out of that environment is probably better for her in the long run, I hope. And being in the suburbs is kind of nice, you know, it's quiet and slow, and I laugh. It's nice and it's strange. It's very, like, there's a big debate going on in the Facebook group of the development that I'm in about how mad people are that one of the restaurants opening is a Chili's. And I'm like, oh my God, this is where I am right now. But there's also something, I don't know, there's something like so innocent about it. There's just something so wholesome about that argument that I'm like, oh, this is such a relief. Cause you know, on Dumpster Fire, sometimes we'll cover things and it's like, it's dark out there. It can make you really cynical and jaded. And I don't want to become, I want to maintain that optimism that like I see naturally in my daughter, how joyful and curious and wanting to engage she is. I feel like she's taught me a lot in this moment about a path forward.
It's funny you mentioned Chili's though. I just saw this Washington Post article where they were like tracking that the best, or I guess the cross-section of a particularly socioeconomic I guess it was like cell phone data, that where is the biggest cross section? It's in Chili's essentially. It's like it crosses, you know, from the high end to the low end. Chili's is pretty good, I gotta say.
I mean, they have the best, if they still have the same recipe they had when I was like in high school, which maybe they don't, but they used to have the best chocolate milkshakes of anywhere.
Really? Okay. Yes. I've not had the milkshake. All right. Well, that's a good one for a good tip for people. More with Bridget, including the Fourth Watch Lightning Round on Glenn Beck, Joe Rogan, and more. Available for paid subscribers of Fourth Watch on Substack. Go to fourthwatch.media to try it. Remember, Fourth Watch is not just a podcast, also a newsletter. Subscribe for free over there at fourthwatch.media. Join me. Let's build a better media together. Thanks so much to Bridget. Really enjoyed talking with her. One of my favorite people in the press today. And I want to tell you, if you like the music in this show, as I do, check out the artist who created it. That's super duper music on Instagram. Song is Far From Falling. Download it wherever you get your music. And download, follow, like, rate, review this podcast on Spotify, on Apple, or wherever you get your podcast for free. back soon. Stay safe. Talk to you then.